Mirror Man, a metaphysical adventure in the spirit of the universe. Playful, loving, deep. By Stephen X. Roberts. Read by the author. But before we begin, a brief disclaimer titled, They Call It Fiction for a Reason. Certain readers will not be surprised to learn that the fictional Swami and Mirror Man is based on Paramahansa Yogananda, 1893-1952, whose spirit animates my life. That said, any reader who takes literally anything the Swami says or does as an expression of Yogananda is confusing my imagination, unencumbered by facts, with the reality of Yogananda's presence in the world. For an authoritative understanding of that, please turn to the organization he founded, Self-Realization Fellowship. And now, Chapter 1, On Your Knees, Blindfolded. The Iroquois and the Chamber of Commerce said that God created New York's Finger Lakes by placing one of his hands on the earth, the resulting imprint giving birth to 11 lakes side by side, their size anywhere from 6 to 40 miles in length, one of them shaped like the letter Y. Funny, Hyman thought, how you can spend your life getting to know somebody and never notice they've got a quirk in their anatomy. When it came to knowing God, Hyman was nobody special. Like everyone else, he had spent innumerable lives brutalizing all sorts of people, himself especially, in the name of just about anything you can imagine. Goodness, virtue, honor, and the hairstyles of others being among the more commonplace, big as they are on the list of things about which we humans have yet to develop much of a sense of humor. But then, as we all do, sooner or later, they say. Somewhere around the millionth time he swatted the fleas in his hair with an ice pick, or struck a strike-anywhere match on the tonsils of a crocodile, or saved the world by killing everyone who didn't look like him, hoping that, golly, maybe this time the outcome would be different, Hyman cried uncle. In response, as always happens, every particle of creation put on a party hat and cheered. Soon, Hyman's existence, life after life, became an active practice of freeing whatever pain and fear arose within him, and of forgiving himself for any harmful choice he had made in any incarnation, past or present. And the more fear and pain washed through him and each unloving choice was embraced and forgiven, the space created in its wake trembled increasingly with compassion. Such is the mathematical precision of the universe, the journey of souls over countless lifetimes to their inevitable and conscious union with the One, the infinite spirit beyond creation, the cosmic sphere of light, joy, and love in which worlds and universes are floating like bubbles, the beginning, middle, and end of every story, which is to say, samadhi, nirvana, the whole enchilada. To be sure, Hyman was still learning to behold all permutations as mere wavelets of change appearing and disappearing on the changeless ocean of infinity, which is to say, he was no avatar, no Christ or Buddha. But his consciousness had evolved to where there were times Hyman couldn't look at a blade of grass or a tuna melt without hearing the divine whispering in his ear, "Hello, playmate. I am here." Then there was that other thing. In his presence, every once in a while and out of the blue, someone would experience a view of themselves that was much larger than what their ordinary everyday perceptions told them. Hyman was no more responsible for these awakenings than a telephone or a drum or a paintbrush is responsible for the wisdom it transmits. He was simply the delivery boy. Who was given this blessing or why, he didn't know, at least not ahead of time. Some recipients seemed ready for it, others seemed simply to need it, ready or not. It was as though a few select souls were being given a glimpse of the future, say a few thousand years down the evolutionary highway, when humankind would be more open to the notion that each moment is a mirror, showing us ourselves. And as a mirror, the gift of any moment is its revelation of what is calling to be embraced, so that we may become more of who we truly are, beings with an infinite capacity to love. On the day our story begins, the seldom-traveled country lane Hyman was hiking, part of an afternoon wander, ran near the top of a hillside that overlooked several miles of water, given a place to rest by that most anomalous of the divine fingers. Vineyards banked most of the road, and hallelujah, this was the season when every cluster was pregnant to near bursting with the year's crop, making your nose give thanks it was naked. Hyman had never been this way before. He had found it, like he found most things, not exactly by accident, but serendipitously, following the guidance of his inner compass. Without breaking stride, he took his bandana from a back pocket and wiped his face, then tied the blue print cloth loosely around his neck. Weather permitting, t-shirt, chinos, and hiking boots was Hyman's everyday wardrobe. This afternoon's shirt was white, the word yes, Y-E-S-S, exclamation point, silk screen, small and dark blue letters centered heart high. His other t-shirts, in a variety of pastels, said other things in the same indigo type. Hyman had a slew of t-shirts, each one different. Every day, often more than once, he would shut his eyes, reach into his suitcase, feel around, and discover the message of the moment. Some people threw the I Ching. Hyman picked t-shirts. The home Hyman was drawing near on the right, sitting halfway up a long hill, had been built originally sometime during the 20 years prior to the Civil War, Hyman recalled. Hyman had been a slave in that life, a man. He'd never learned a whole lot about that incarnation, except that he and his master's son, a female impersonator, which is a whole other story we'll get to a little later, were lovers and lived in New York City, where one of their neighbors was an architect. Maybe this was how Hyman acquired the cellular memory that told him that this particular house and the stables behind it had been authentically restored. It was a good story, anyway. A Kentucky Derby winner, in full gallop, would still take at least half a minute to cover the immense lawn that flowed down from house to road. A number of tall, mature oaks stood randomly among a few smaller offspring, creating a park-like feeling. Not far from the road, the land had been leveled off to fashion a family baseball diamond, and on the mound that afternoon, a young woman, 6'1" or 2", college age, dressed in black riding pants, a purple t-shirt, and baseball spikes with short-cropped yellow socks, was pitching a neon orange softball like a rocket to a man squatting behind the plate in a white, paint-spattered jumpsuit. Hyman didn't need any internal guidance telling him that the man was the girl's father, since the man considered the girl in a way that occurs when you believe that the only thing keeping your kid from walking on water is that it hadn't yet dawned on her to try. Each pitch seemed faster or somehow more powerful than the one before. No sooner did the dad toss back the ball than the girl would whirl through her windmill windup, limbs a blur and seemingly out of control, until the ball left her hand and miraculously smacked into the center of the catcher's mitt where the father had positioned it. And the instant that whap cracked, the girl's own gloved hand was up and open, waiting for the ball to be returned to her, as though her very life depended on breaking the Guinness record for the number of strikes thrown in a certain period, or on mashing her father's alcoholic nose all over his baby-faced jowls should he lose his concentration for a split second. So this is why I've walked this way, Hyman thought. Hyman noticed a woman sitting not far from the road, her back against the trunk of a tree about as big around as a couple of sumo wrestlers. She, too, wore riding breeches, hers the color of a chocolate truffle, and a blue cotton work shirt, sleeves rolled to the elbow. Her feet were bare, her toenails painted American flag red. Next to her on the lawn was a cell phone, a small stack of plastic cups in primary colors, and an antique gallon jar sweating chili with iced tea laced with wafers of lime and sprigs of mint. It was the girl's mother, both having the same lanky frame and mahogany hair, the mom's cut hedgehog short with random straws of gray, the daughter's a long single braid dancing the length of her spine. The mom gave a neighborly wave to the passing stranger. Hyman returned the wave, adding a nod toward the mound. Nice to see someone with a lot of passion, he said, stopping at the road's edge. She'd appreciate you saying so, the mom said. Almost won the College World Series this year. Hyman and the girl's mother stood and sat respectively, watching the daughter and dad. Hyman felt the woman's response to his presence. It surprised her, having this stranger standing there behind her. Silent rather than be annoying was oddly pleasant. The mom had this goofy fantasy of the stranger walking over to her and saying, "I'm sorry to disturb you, but I'm your twin brother Bob, and we were separated at birth." She almost laughed out loud at the thought. "Say," she said, "care for some iced tea?" "Why, how kind. Sure, thanks for asking." "Well, come take a load off. I'm Shorty Fox." "Hyman O'Malley." "O'Malley. O'Malley. Are you by any wild chance related to Jackie O'Malley of California, the famous horse whisperer of my childhood?" "Matter of fact, he's my pop." "Good Lord, I was just being silly. As a girl, I read all his books again and again. Pardon me for not knowing. Is your dad still alive?" Within the hour, Hyman, kneeling on second base, wearing his blue bandana as a blindfold, threw 10 strikes in a row to Shorty's daughter, Pearl. After strike 10, a curve that sailed around the moon before swooping to nip the inside corner of the plate, Pearl jogged out to Hyman, pulled up his blindfold, handed him the ball, and said, "Teach." Hyman winked. "First, grasshopper, we must watch the sunrise over the lake." Sunrise, to Pearl, when school was out, Hyman knew, was as familiar as licorice pizza. So he laughed when she, all business, took her ball back and said, "How about tomorrow, mass man?" There is a period at the end of night, but before dawn, when the earth holds her breath. Frogs stuff socks in their mouths. Owls zip it. Coyotes eat their chicken dinners in the dreamtime. Sparrows know that chattering now would be like gossiping in church. From the sacred peace of these few silent moments, a new day is born in the east, the direction of awakening. Should it have come to pass that during this brief interlude, 7-foot green beings with pink stars for belly buttons suddenly appeared and promised to free the earth of all pollution if only Pearl and the nice avuncular gent with her would teach the boys and girls of Planet Chlorophyll how to cha-cha, the event would have been no more surprising to Pearl than what she actually was about to experience. But neither she nor Hyman, sitting together by the lake, had a glimmer of what was to unfold. Pearl, because she couldn't see the future, and Hyman, because he preferred not to look. If he asked, his guides would show Hyman just about any future he wished to see. And someday,
Whether he asked or not, he was sure, second sight would simply be dumped in his lap, like it or not. That was fine. Hyman could read minds easily enough if he wished, which he almost never did. It was like listening in on random phone calls. The thrill wanes quickly. It was true that all sorts of extraneous information floated his way unbidden, some of it even about the future. He didn't pay much attention to it, unless it became the equivalent of a tiger in a top hat offering free haircuts. Hyman was uneasy when it came to clairvoyance, his own anyway. In more than one former life, he had been especially prescient and misused the gift, leaving a lot of blood on the highway, literal and metaphoric. While he had cleared much of the unforgiveness he carried from those choices, every once in a while an opportunity to serve by seeing the future would pop up, and his first reaction would be to shy away, afraid he might harm again. He was grateful whenever it was brought to the surface, however. Feeling it, freeing it, forgiving himself was always good. No question he was getting more sanguine about the prospect of foresight. He just didn't go out of his way looking for it.
Which was one reason he had no idea that before the cock crowed the following day, his kidnapping would be ordered by the President of the United States and executed.